This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Regulations of the financial variety, the business of our national parks, and hey, how much are you making? Oh, wait, I'm not allowed to ask that, am I? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, 25 October 2017. Glad as always to have you along, everybody. There are few government agencies as squarely in Republicans' sights as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's been a thorn in the GOP's side since it was created after the financial crisis to, as the name pretty much flat out says, protect consumers from financial fraud and abuse. And that, in a roundabout kind of way, gets us to late last night and a tie-breaking vote by Vice President Mike Pence to kill off a new CFPB rule that would have let consumers bring class action lawsuits against banks and credit card companies. The Obama-era rule banned banks from forcing their customers into arbitration, and we will get to what that means for consumer disputes in just a second. First of all, though, Marketplace's Amy Scott and the CFPB's questionable medium-term future.
Days after the CFPB's sixth birthday this summer, Senator Elizabeth Warren held a press conference. She said the agency has returned nearly $12 billion in refunds and restitution to consumers.
Because it is working, the Republicans want to find every way they can to bring it down.
Last night's Senate vote was a small step in that direction. Christopher Peterson is a former advisor to CFPB Director Richard Cordray. He says a bigger threat is a bill known as the Financial Choice Act, pending in the Senate.
It takes away almost all of its powers to actually bring meaningful consumer protection enforcement cases.
Many conservatives say the Bureau has too much power. It's run by a single director who can't easily be fired by the president. And James Copeland with the Manhattan Institute says it's funded by the Federal Reserve, not Congress.
I just think it needs to be constructed in a real and logical way and not this sort of shadow state regulatory authority that's completely divorced from the democratic process that we have elections over.
Ed Merzwinski with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group says it's one thing to chip away at the rules.
Getting rid of the Consumer Bureau is a much tougher lift for them.
Even if the bill fails, Cordray's term expires next July. President Trump is expected to appoint someone friendlier to banking. And Republicans are expected to take another swing at a new rule curbing payday lenders. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, here is what last night's vote means in practical application. More arbitration fine print in more and more contracts, which you would be forgiven for thinking would mean more arbitration and thus a boon for the arbitration industry. We would forgive you for thinking that, but you would be wrong. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that one.
Arbitrators' phones aren't exactly ringing off the hook with consumers looking to challenge their lenders. Alex Carter teaches mediation and alternative dispute resolution at Columbia Law School.
When consumers don't have the opportunity to share costs and risk and band together in a class action lawsuit, usually the reaction is to give up.
The argument for these clauses is that class action lawsuits take up more time and resources than arbitration. And consumers, even if they win, don't win much once the money is divided among the pool and lawyers take their cut. Ted Frank is with the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Class actions transfer wealth from middle-class consumers to millionaire lawyers.
But the economics of going it alone instead of in a class action are tough, says Jean Sternlight. She runs the Center for Conflict Resolution at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Most people don't have the time, energy, or emotional fortitude to file an individual claim. I myself wouldn't file a claim for a pretty small amount of money, and I'm an attorney and a law professor who focuses on these kinds of issues.
Paul Bland, the executive director of the nonprofit group Public Justice, says you can see this in the data.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau studied every single case that any consumer in America had brought in front of arbitration over a three-year period, and it averaged about 400 cases a year.
That small number, Bland says, is why the CFPB created this rule in the first place. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
As long as we're on regulation, one more thing. The second season, episode number one of our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, drops today, a season all about red tape and bureaucracy, regulations that shape this economy and our democracy, and why that subject matters so much right now. Subscribe, obviously, wherever you get your podcasts. On Wall Street today, hey, this just in, stocks, it turns out, don't go up every day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Among the many, many negotiations going on right now in Washington, in addition to taxes and, yes, still health care, is immigration. Specifically, what's going to happen to the 800,000 or so people currently being protected under DACA? While Congress and the White House try to get on the same page or even close to it, DACA recipients, after the president's action last month, are in limbo. Will they be able to finish their educations? Are they going to lose their jobs? And for tens of thousands of them, what is going to happen to the businesses they have built? Marketplace's Rima Kreis spent time with a couple in San Diego that is wrestling with exactly those questions.
Back in high school, Luis Tinico and Dulce Garcia rolled in different circles. Tinico was that super loud guy in the hallways, always making a joke out of something.
And I was the opposite, really quiet, really shy, really serious.
That's why I never talked to her, because she was always like with the mean face. I was like, I don't want to get close to her.
Not mean.
Yeah, quiet face.
Garcia says she was just focused, a steadfast 16-year-old with a 20-year plan.
I was going to conquer the world. I was going to go off to school, become a lawyer one day. I had hopes of being a judge someday.
That was before Garcia says she realized what it meant to be undocumented. She graduated and got accepted into her dream school, the University of California, Davis. But back then, without a social security number, she couldn't take out loans to pay for it. So instead, she went to community college and stayed put in San Diego. A year later, she and Tinico crossed paths again at a party.
And that's when we actually both start talking about our struggles.
Tinico's also undocumented, and like Garcia, he was brought to the U.S. from Mexico when he was just a little kid.
We find the similarity of what we wanted in life and what we couldn't achieve at the time.
They've been together ever since. For 15 years, they've pushed each other to achieve what they wanted in life, worked multiple jobs that paid under the table, took night classes, saved whatever they could. And today?
We're in my office. This is my second office. I opened this office this May.
Garcia, now 34, did become a lawyer, doing mostly immigration work. Her degrees, along with an American flag, decorate the walls of her small firm. Tinico, his hands stained from grease, points toward his business, an auto body shop.
It's just two blocks away from here. It's not that far.
Together, Garcia and Tinico have hired six people, and their businesses are doing well enough that they've bought a house together. And Tinico recently expanded into a bigger shop. According to the Center for American Progress, about 40,000 DACA recipients have started their own businesses after enrolling in the program. Garcia says her legal status under DACA gave her a sense of security.
It meant that I could walk into any of the government offices and ask for the business name, the business license, the employer ID number. It meant that I can walk into any door and it's not going to be close to my face.
At the end of the day, it's more of clarity of where your business is going to go. Before, I was just like, I can lose it tomorrow.
Both recently renewed their DACA status until 2019. If the program isn't saved, more DACA recipients could go into business for themselves, since it would be harder to hold on to their jobs. But Garcia says her practice would likely collapse.
I wouldn't be able to walk into an ICE office to check in a client. I wouldn't be able to walk into immigration court because my opponent would be ready to issue notice to appear for me.
And she says immigration cases can last years. Who knows if she has that much time?
I can't imagine someone that would say, oh, I'm dealing with this very traumatic experience in my life right now that I'm here to get help with, but I'm also going to have to deal with my lawyer's drama.
Tinico says he'd keep right on fixing cars, despite the risk.
I'm not going to hide. No. It took me so hard to build this, to establish this.
In the meantime, Garcia is putting her legal training to work. for herself. She and five other DACA recipients filed suit against the Trump administration last month, trying to block it from ending the program. Not long after the suit became public, the nasty voicemails started rolling in.
You have leached off of our country. I want you to go home and make your own country great. This is not your country.
Garcia says she doesn't let people like that get to her. But when one man, not a client, left her a one-star review on her business page, that crossed the line.
This business is like my child right now. And it's like, oh, gosh, you can attack me personally. But when you go after my business, now we're talking, right? Now, like, I'm really, truly angry.
Because she says not everything has to do with how she got here. This is about what she's done since she's been here, since she was that shy 16-year-old with a 20-year plan. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
President Trump said today he did not specifically authorize the operation in Niger in which four soldiers were killed a week or so ago. That happens to be true, although it is jarring to hear him say aloud, because it is exactly the way the president said he would run military operations, delegating more authority to commanders in the field. But that mission and questions about what happened to those soldiers comes as there is a nascent move in Congress, small but nascent, to rethink something called the Authorization for Use of Military Force, AUMF in the vernacular, that lawmakers last voted on after September 11th, 16 years ago. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has the economics of long-running military operations.
U.S. military involvement stretches far beyond Iraq and Afghanistan. Some operations are classified, but as best we can tell, outside of those two big wars,
there are about a half a dozen places around the world where special operations forces are operating with live ammunition.
Mark Kansian, a retired Marine colonel, is now with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Niger is one of those half dozen. There's Yemen.
But also Nigeria, where we're looking for Boko Haram. The Philippines, where special operations forces are helping to operate against Islamic extremism. There's Mali.
But these represent just a handful of the missions. The military also works with countries all over the world to train and support local security forces and gather intelligence.
More broadly, we are involved in hundreds of military operations throughout the world.
And in at least 75 countries, far more than we were a decade ago, says Linda Bilmes. She tracks the human and financial costs of war at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
The main areas of growth have been spending through special operations forces, predator drones, as well as training operations for many troops around the world.
Funding can be tied to specific branches of the military or counterterrorism more broadly. Given the varied scope of these smaller missions,
it's almost impossible to tell how much they cost.
Gordon Adams follows defense spending at the Stimson Center. He estimates maybe $10 to $15 billion gets spent on special operations forces, plus another $10 billion or so for equipment. Not a lot by military standards.
They don't have big bases. They don't have large commissaries. They don't have housing for families. They are much smaller operations, so they're likely to be cheaper, but much more widespread.
But because the money for these operations comes from so many different places and goes so many different places and Americans are dying, now Congress is calling for a clearer accounting. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
employers don't react as well when women negotiate.
And therein lies a big picture economic problem. But first, let's do the numbers. When was the last time you heard the sad music, huh? I don't even know. Dow Industrial's down 112.4%, 23,329. NASDAQ off 34, about a half percent, 65.63. The S&P 500 off 11, 0.4%, 25.57. Drinks maker Dr. Pepper Snapple. Say that 10 times fast. Said recent hurricanes and earthquakes in the United States and Mexico caused significant disruptions in sales last quarter. That in turn shook up its share price down 4.6%. AT&T brought in $39.8 billion in revenue last quarter, but that was lower than Wall Street was forecasting, so its shares slid 3.9% because capitalism. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.43%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In National Park Service news today, first of all, there is some. Second of all, it's going to cost you. The government is thinking about raising entrance fees to some of the most popular parks in this country, Yellowstone, Grand Canyon, Shenandoah, and Acadia among them. Almost double in some cases to $70 a car. The money's going to go for what the National Park Service says are essential repairs to park facilities, which makes this next interview especially timely. Actually, the National Park Foundation is the official charity of the National Park Service. It raises private funds for the national parks. Will Shafroth is the CEO. Will, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you, Kai.
It is an interesting time now in the government and in the Department of the Interior, specifically, of which the National Park Service is a part, just because of all the controversy over national monuments, which are not part of the Park Service, but also just how we use our public lands.
That's right. Actually, some of the national monuments are part of the Park Service. Many of the other ones that are under review right now are in fact, managed by the Bureau of Land Management.
But to the point, you know, Secretary Zinke has some views on how public lands ought to be used in this country. It must be a little awkward when the head of the National Park Service and maybe yourself as well get in the same room with him.
You know what? Secretary Zinke has been hugely supportive of the national parks and understands the value of public-private partnerships. So he's a member of our board of directors, and he has been actually quite supportive of the work that we're doing to raise private funds to support the kind of work that's happening in the Park Service.
I imagine it's an easy ask when you say, listen, we need X amount of dollars for the National Park Foundation, because who doesn't like the national parks?
Yes.
It's just funny. You rolled your eyes. And I'm like, wait, what?
Well, it's because we're competing for people's charitable dollars, in effect, because they care about their schools and their civic interests. They care about social services. And so we have to make a case and really appeal to their emotions in many cases to ensure that we get a piece of their charitable pie. And so, yeah, I mean, the great thing about national parks is that there is something for everybody.
There is something in the national parks and in the great outdoors for everybody, but there is also a diversity issue with access to and the people who use the national parks in this country. How do you, since it's your job, not mine, get that access more widely distributed, I guess is a way to put it?
It's a great question. It was one of the big questions that led into the centennial of the national parks a few years ago. We actually did some research with the National Park Service to look at who is coming to the parks. Yeah. The millennial generation, which actually self-identifies as 45% non-white, so by definition very diverse, was not finding the national parks very relevant to their lives. And so we started something called the Find Your Park campaign and began to awaken that generation to the importance of national parks. And we're beginning to see some real movement in their engagement and their advocacy and support of the parks.
And attendance, do you see people of color and younger people getting into the national parks?
Yeah, there isn't actually a demographic survey that the Park Service they don't like check people at the gate and you know have them fill out a form, but we know that the visitation's up dramatically in the last 4 years. About 60 million more people went in 2016 than 2013.
When you leave this job in however long you decide that's going to be, what do you hope the national park system in this country looks like?
Well, I'm hoping that the national park system can be healthier, if you will. And what I mean by that is that they have the resources they need to support the kinds of work that needs to happen. And every park is experiencing different levels of their maintenance backlog being oversubscribed. And so there's a $12 billion need in the system to support basic maintenance.
Is that right?
Yeah. They have a $3 billion annual budget to cover everything. And on top of that, there's a $12 billion backlog.
$3 billion budget and a $12 billion backlog. It's not like you guys can raise enough money to fix that, right? Is there a way that, I guess, outside sources? Or how can that be fixed? Because that's not sustainable.
Well, I think there's a lot of interest in Congress right now in addressing that maintenance backlog. There are actually bills that have been introduced, and I know the administration is looking closely at this. I also think that we can be more effective in deploying private investment dollars.
Should we go to like Honeywell for AC improvements and GE for lighting in the parks? Is that what I'm hearing?
Could be, yeah. Well, there's a lot of different lighting companies that are helping. In Big Bend National Park, for instance, there was a lighting company that went in there and reduced the lighting bill by more than 90%.
Huh.
We also want to see that the parks are visited by all citizens of this country. And finally, that they are not just the places that everybody knows about, Yellowstone and Grand Teton and Yosemite and Grand Canyon, but the lesser known parks. And I would hope that the visitation is spread so those kinds of places are appreciated as well.
Will Shafroth at the National Park Foundation. Will, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
I did have a couple other questions for Will, including whether it might not just be easier if Congress, you know, ponied up for the whole cost of running our national parks. Also, whether he worries about the Disneyfication of some of those places. The answers on our Corner Office podcast. To the list of things one is not allowed to ask an applicant in a job interview, in addition to the basics like are you married or do you have kids, one can now add in an increasing number of states, how much did you make in your last job? The goal here is to take on the persistent gender pay gap. Women still earn on average about 80 cents to a man's dollar, so states are trying to make sure past pay discrimination isn't simply perpetuated. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looked at how that might play out in reality.
Massachusetts started the trend, passing a law last year that bans employers from asking for a job candidate's salary history, which is a common question on job applications. In 2017, California, Oregon, Delaware, and Puerto Rico joined in, along with a handful of cities, including New York. And why do advocates for reducing the pay gap between men and women think it's a good idea to bar employers from using salary history in hiring and negotiating compensation? Here's Emily Martin, general counsel at the National Women's Law Center.
Taking salary history out of the equation does ensure that discrimination can't follow you from job to job. If you are discriminated against early in your career, that hasn't impacted your earnings for the next decade.
California is the largest state so far to enact a salary history ban. Some groups representing employers oppose the new law, predicting it will increase the risk of litigation. Christina Lawney, a partner at law firm Seyfarth Shaw in Sacramento, says employers have other concerns.
It could cause difficulties for employers' ability to attract talent, negotiate wages, ensure that the employer and the applicant have compensation expectations more or less on the same page from early on.
Lonnie says requiring a job candidate to provide her salary history can be a legitimate tool for determining how much more to offer to get that person to leave her current job and come on board. This is a complaint the National Women's Law Center has heard before. Emily Martin says employers should use labor market data, a candidate's job experience, skills, and education to set salary. And she says it's problematic to negotiate using past salary as a guide.
That is another place where unjustified inequities creep in. Women tend to ask for less in negotiations than men. Employers don't react as well when women negotiate.
Martin says employers should just set clear salary ranges and share that information with applicants. In Oregon, a new salary history ban just took effect this month. From its office in downtown Portland, Mammoth HR provides human resources advice to employers across the country, and the firm's been fielding questions about how to comply with these new laws. Director Kerry Lear points out even companies that aren't based in a place with a salary history ban may be hiring workers who are. Her advice?
Just take the salary questions off for everyone. We expect other states to be joining along. Employers might as well just get ahead of it.
Lear says the new laws could be a minefield for employers. For instance, job candidates can still volunteer their salary history. But under Oregon's law...
You really shouldn't be using it to make any determinations about the salary that's going to be paid.
Meanwhile, Lear says banned questions are still pervasive among employers in Oregon and other affected states. According to the National Women's Law Center, this year nearly half of states considered legislation to ban asking about salary history in hiring. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am reasonably certain avocado toast jumps the shark. Courtesy of the website Extra Crispy, this item, a pop-up avocado restaurant in Sydney, Australia. First of all, think about that for just a second. But anyway, this pop-up avocado restaurant in Sydney, Australia has a help wanted ad going. Head of Avo Control is the job title. Among the requirements, quote, a minimum 2 years experience in smashing avocados on toast or similar, and, quote, a healthy history of successful avocado selection, end of quote. I could go on, but I'm not gonna. All right, we got to go today. And your reminder that markets go down as well. The Dow off 112, 0.4%. NASDAQ down 34. That's about 0.5%. S&P 500 off 11 points. Sarah Bruguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Justat, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Talladay engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.